A Hero's Journey is a podcast filled with spoilers. We recommend reading the book each week before you listen, but we trust you to make your own decision.
Hi, and welcome to A Hero's Journey, a literary podcast. I'm your host and judge, Jack, and I'm here with my plagued people.
This is Alex.
And I'm Zach.
And I am joined by special guest judge,
Josh,
who is a good friend of ours who got us into this wonderful series. Each week, we look at a different book through Joseph Campbell's monomyth.
This week, we're discussing The Hyena and the Hawk by Adrian Zakowski, which is the final book in the Echoes of the Fall series. So this book actually follows multiple point of views, just like the previous one did, where we'll even mid-chapter or at the beginning of a chapter, we'll switch point of views between multiple different characters, Loud Thunder, Hesbrek, the one hyena girl. But the one person who has the most point of views is Many Tracks. And we follow the journey of the entire kind of tribe-changing people as they learn more about the plague people who've come to invade them. They thought maybe at the end of the last book that they pushed them off with that battle on the shoreline, but that was just a start. And the plague people have been, plaguing these shapeshifters for quite some time now. They've established kind of forts, these tent forts across the plains and the northern parts of the country, as well as attacking and destroying lots of parts of the riverland. And so Many Tracks convinces at first a group of plains people to fight back. She becomes captured by the plague people and experimented on to some extent and observed. She ends up escaping, reuniting with her war band, as well as with the multiple different factions that are trying to resist the plague people, learning more about who they are and where they came from, and then eventually using that information as well as a spiritual journey to the God's land to drive the plague people away from their shores.
We begin this journey, like all of our journeys, with our departure from the ordinary in a world being invaded, which, you know, is just where really every third book should begin.
Yeah, as Jack talks about, we're following Many Tracks here as she works with, you know, her own abilities as well as her partners and various factions to drive out the invaders forever. For our call to adventure, it's the learning about the plague people and needing to head north, right? She just, at the end of the last book, has kind of helped Ansan fight the civil war that was happening in the South Riverlands and kind of finalize that up. And it's really that she learns about, and she's kind of unaware of the fight that Loud Thunder is having with the plague people in the north. Once she learns about it, she realizes that this is a huge danger, and that's really the danger that the priests have been forecasting for so long all across the lands, right? Pretty much the priests of every god had forewarned this, but she didn't know what it was foretelling, and now she has her answer. So she learns about the plague people and needs to head north, a pretty good call to adventure. For the refusal of the call, there's a scene in one of the plains people villages in which many ways staying with one of the plains dogs tribes, and they're talking about how they're going to attack a group of plague peoples that are in the distance. And there's a straight up quote from the book that says that Many Tracks wanted to say this was not her fight, right? She was afraid of the outcome. She didn't want to be a participant. She ultimately decides that as a champion of not just one race or tribe, that she's a champion of many diverse people, especially those who don't have champions, that this is her fight. But she does, toy with that self-doubt that we like in the refusal of the call. Like, why am I doing this? This is dangerous. I don't want to be involved. For the meeting the mentor, we have the bat. Now, the bat, we're heavily sort of forecasted throughout the second book. They show up a little bit at the end of the second book with Loud Thunder, but this is the first interaction that Many Tracks has with all the bats seem like they're priests, or they're kind of like the serpents in that nature. But he shows up at the camp and talks about how he can help them fight against the plague people, and that his voice, while annoying to them, will be terrifying to the plague people. So he provides a militaristic advantage as well as a knowledge about the plague people that they sort of are in a little bit of the dark about. For the crossing of the threshold, we have when Herkrow kills one of the plague people bugs. He ventures out and smashes this, it seems like a massive beetle, you know, the size of perhaps like a golf bag or something. It's kind of hard to tell in their description, but it's this extremely large beetle. They don't really know how it relates to the plague people. They think it might be a pet or a beast of burden of some sort, but it's certainly nothing that good will come of it. And so once they've engaged with the plague people, it's not only providing information of, oh, this is stuff that we didn't know about, but this is also sort of the first confrontation between many tracks and the plague people. For the belly of the whale, we have the actual, okay, now it's time to go out and not just do a skirmish, it's time for an actual battle. And so they come up with a game plan. They have all different types of shapeshifters there. They go on an attack, and the attack's going, you know, fairly well. She's afraid at first in several instances, but her champion soul is able to lock that fear away. The bat comes in and provides that strategic advantage. Things are going real great until an airship pops out of the sky, and things really take a turn for the worse. A lot of kind of the C-list characters end up getting killed by what we know to be guns, but the characters do not. And many tracks is captured by the plague people, which is her point of no return.
All right. So our adventure, I think this is perfect. This is definitely the goal of all of the characters from the beginning of this book, not just many tracks here. For our call to adventure, though, this learning of the plague people, I mean, we already know about the plague people, right? Many tracks fought them before, or am I misremembering that?
She didn't fight them last book.
She
became aware of them at the end of, towards the end of last book.
Yeah, this is the first direct encounter.
Okay, well then, in that case, I think that call is okay. Needing to head north towards her own people, and presumably we would think heading all the way north to the crown of the world. I think that's a fine call. Needed to go fight the people with her. Needed to go fight the plague with her own people.
I would also add that as well as it being her first experience, this gives a certain urgency, because if they had made it that far south, then theoretically everyone could have been killed farther north already, as far as she knew at the time.
Right. Yeah. Like an overwhelming force.
That's existential threat mm-hmm. kind of thing. Yeah.
For our refusal of the call, I don't like this very much. I think that there is definitely an aspect of this refusal saying like Maine doesn't want to fight later, but at this time, I don't think she considers really not fighting. You know, later after she's been captured and held captive and weak, she wants to say, this isn't my fight. But at the beginning, she doesn't seem to be refusing the call. I don't know. Josh, what do you think about the character Minitrax? Do you think that she ever really refuses challenges like this? Or at least at this point, do you think she's refusing challenges?
So during the capture, if I remember correctly.
Before the capture, we're talking about like before the
fight. Talking about before the capture, did she refuse it? There were a couple points there. If I recall correctly about that part of the story, she definitely highly considered staying in the Southlands. There was an open offer for her to stay there, and I believe she at least considered it before giving a rather definitive, I need to go back north to my people. Also, right, exactly. So I wouldn't say it was explicitly stated that she considered abandoning the call to adventure before she encountered the plague people. And after she encountered the plague people, there wasn't really an option to give up at that point.
Yeah, we're talking mostly about, I agree, Josh, but we're talking mostly about the scene after the Bat had kind of showed up and they were sitting around thinking, okay, there's plague people nearby. Do we actually have to go fight them? There's a, I wish I had my copy on me. Let's see.
Yeah, I'm going to need the explicit quote there, Zach, because at least for the moment, all of the fear comes from, I remember, comes after where we've sort of got our crossing in belly, and that puts it firmly in temptation.
Yeah, one second. I've got it around here.
Yeah, we're talking about the call to adventure going as far back as when she encountered the bat and he told, and she got more information about them without, before she encountered them.
Yeah, I'm trying to find what he's talking about here.
Well, there was a discussion when they sit down with the bat and they talk a bit about the plague people, and the bat sort of reveals a little that they're an ancient enemy kind of thing. And that, wasn't it that all of the people in that land had initially escaped from them on a different continent or so?
Yeah. Yeah. The brothers, I don't remember the ocean if the bat, between them.
Right. I don't remember if the bat reveals that at that time or not.
All right. I found it here. The grass shadow is looking for her, pushing through the crowd to clap a hand to her shoulder. Champion, he said, will you fight? Will you stand with us? Some small part of her wanted to claim that this was not her fight.
Josh is a definitive book expert.
Right. I mean, as far as I see it, her course is pretty set in her own mind at that part of the book. And even if there are some small doubts, I don't see it as any real intention to possibly not go north and fight.
Yeah. And just to kind of back that up, the end of the quote after a comma was, but in truth, she knew that this was everyone's
fault. Oh, no. Contextualize your quotes, sir.
No, we do this all the time. Weaponize the quote.
That's why Alex double checked him.
All right. For our mentor here, I understand why we picked the bat, you know, with the story of the three brothers, the owl, the serpent, and the bat fighting against the plague people. It does seem like the bat should fit in the story closer. We have Hesperic, who fits in as a mentor early in the book. Right now is not with many tracks, but could have fit the role again if she had been there. And we hear tell that the owl kind of has fallen from their once great and wise position, and now it's just another eerie tribe. But the bat was mysterious, and them getting called up like they were last book seems like they would have a lot to do, be a great force here. But I don't even really see them as a mentor for many treks. I don't know that they do a lot of information sharing or a lot of protecting or gift giving. I know that they are important in that one fight where many tracks is captured, but aside from that, I just don't feel a lot about the bat.
So they straight up save her life at one point. Like, there's the whole point where the fight's literally going to fail, and then the bat comes in and causes panic amongst the people, and they talk about how, like, the whole line was faltering, and without it, they probably all would have been dead.
Yeah, the bat definitely has some impact in some of the fight scenes. Pretty high impact, as you said. Also, right before she's captured during that fight, I believe the bat helps her out again.
There you go. Then a keening rain across the sky, horizon to horizon, almost seemed. The great vane wind monster swooped across the roof of the huts, making a sound only partly with the ears, but more with the whole body. The sound was a stab of pain for many and many others, but it seemed to turn their own fear back on the plague people.
Well, I still don't think they have like a personal relationship, which I know is not 100% necessary, but I like to see a more personal mentee-mentor relationship there.
I agree with you that I would have liked more, but Zach is putting up some solid arguments. We have definitely accepted less, more nebulous mentoring help.
I'm pretty much on the same page there. The bat definitely has information and powers that have not previously been accessible to Manier.
And one of the big ones is during that first introduction scene, he says something that I think is particularly poignant that like comes up several times throughout the story. He says, know this truth. They do not care about you. They do not even believe in you. You are shadows in their world. Mm-hmm. They talk a lot about how, especially when they start talking to the captured plague person later on how the plague people don't even think that they are shapeshifters. They just keep finding dead humans and crazy animals and children. And that she was later when she gets captured is like the first
one they see transform. Right.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. That is fair. For crossing the threshold, the crow killing a bug. I mean, this is definitely when they decide, like, hey, we're going to war, right? That's the same scene there where they decide that, but specifically the crow killing a bug, what does that have to do with this? Because it's not a human bug, right? It's a bug.
Well, so one of them who's already started to change. We know later.
Oh, right. The grotesque.
Yeah, figure. The giant bugs are their shape-shifted form. But well,
they also have giant bugs with them.
Right. I think they use them as labor and stuff for sure. But those bugs are, so they had like lost the art of transformation. And I believe the one she fought was one that had managed to transform.
Because some of them were slipping through, and we even get that one small chapter from the point of view of one of the guys who did switch.
Right. Yeah, but that was later after they saw Manitrax transform, right?
Correct. And he took that as proof that they could still do it. The implication here, I think, is that the bug she killed, well, first of all, it was like alien. She had never seen something like that before, and she knew it was from them. And the implication is that this started her thinking that it could be their transformation.
I will push back against that, Josh. I don't know if you're thinking about a different spot in the story, but just to clarify, even though it might hurt my ultimate point, that the bug I'm talking about is they're still at the Plains camp, and the crow, I think it was Feast on Dreams or something.
Feast on Dreams, yep.
He shows up with an already dead bug that he killed. And it was, but the big problem.
Oh, I apologize. Was this the smaller one, not the full man sized one?
Yeah, this is the smaller one, and it's one that's pretty much like the start of the they're nearby sort of introduction to that scene.
Oh, then yeah, I'm too far forward from where you're at.
Yeah, this is the first
time she like finds out that they're nearby.
Yeah, this is the why did you engage without us talking about it? Because Feeds on Dream is on his own like personal vendetta. And also, how far away were you, sort of thing? And that's what triggers the crap, we gotta do something.
Yeah. Okay. I think the distance more than the fact that it's a plague.
Oh yeah, it's not about issue. The bug part. It's just that the enemy is nearby. Yeah.
Although the crow is insistent that it is a transformed person. I don't believe him.
And nobody does.
Yeah.
I mean, the plague people are soulless, so clearly the crow is full of shit. But that is some imminent danger on a war closer than we could have possibly anticipated. We thought we were going much farther north. So that... that is a threshold for me, especially because unlike, the bestest boy, Loud Thunder, she has not fought the plague people before, so this is new.
Right. I'm with you on this.
All right. And then...
Alex, you're just slipping, man.
I know. our belly here, I'm going to lose because I think it's good. I like how it introduces Manitrax to the plague people. And more specifically to her journey in here, where she's going to learn that the plague people have gods and they were once souled people and can transform. And she can't really do that without this interaction between herself and the scientist. Josh, is there anything else about this scene that you think like drives the story forward or anything else about the capture specifically?
This, for the first time in a long while, this puts her in sort of intimate contact with her own weakness once more. She loses everything that she had previously gained in the last two novels during this period, and she's forced to cope with the startling reality of the Plague Men on top of that. So a huge, huge formative moment, I really think.
Yeah, I can see that. I agree with that. So I think it's a good belly, Zach. Good job.
I do have a good belly.
And that is going to close us out on our departure on my end with just that refusal of the call missing, a classic gung-ho hero.
Yeah, so far during the departure, it looks like Jack and I are in agreement on pretty much every point. The only one that I personally am not 100% on was the one we were talking about, the bat as meeting the mentor. I'm still not fully on board. I believe he meets the strict qualifications to be a mentor, but given the context of his relationship with Manier in the book and his contributions both at that time and later on, it really doesn't feel as solid in the role as I would like. Though, as Jack mentioned, depending on which book you look at, you don't always get a role like that to fit every criteria.
In a classic being held captive situation, we come to our initiation.
And Josh, you said her name right, so say it again for me. Galathea?
Galathea.
Galathea. Okay. So I have chosen Galathea as the meeting with the higher power. There's a lot of insight that Galathea provides to many tracks in a one-on-one conversation after her escape that brings to light certain aspects of what the plague people's goals are and what their kind of methods are that I don't think had been solidified in her mind. You know, it seems like Hesperek at least had an idea of what was going on, but it was really Galathea that provided the insight for many tracks. And for the Atonement with Creator, we jump forward a bit to this final battle scene with all of the forces fighting, Loud Thunders leading the war host, and many tracks is leading a ritual of priests that propel her into the God's Land. In order to kind of figure out what they need to stop the gods. And she interacts directly with the wolf there, as well as the tiger and her champion spirit, the things that kind of make her the person that she is, the three soul types of her identity. They created the many tracks that we know today. And so I think this is a really cool Atonement with the Creator moment. In fact, she stands on the shoulders of the champion in order to reach the stars for our ultimate boon. But before we get there, we have the apotheosis. Many tracks is feeling defeated. She's just on the cusp of getting there, but she doesn't know if she can. Hesperek shows up and shares with her this last secret that the plague peoples are not entirely soulless. It's just we sealed their gods and souls away amongst the stars in the God's Land. And so she reaches up with her giant iron axe and cleaves the sky in two, I think it says, releases those stars and those gods, the insect gods, which essentially in the side of the real world, not happening in the God's Land, the fight's going okay, but the shapeshifters are losing. There's just overwhelming odds and technology. And it's that when she releases these gods and all these quote-unquote normal humans, these plague people start shape-shifting into insects uncontrollably in and out, causes mass panic amongst the plague people, and they're completely routed. Now, there are roles that are played by, you know, B-list characters throughout the scene that are in support of that defeat and that eventual victory, but it's Many's tracks that we're focusing on as the ultimate linchpin.
All right, so let's go to the Road of Trials first. Why not? Got a long road to walk here.
Would you say it has many tracks?
It does have many tracks on it, yes. All right. So first, escaping capture from the plague people. I like this because like we had talked about, Minitrax is vulnerable during this time, and she learns a lot, and the information that she gathers here about the plague people is what does eventually lead to their destruction and forcing them out of the land. However, my biggest quibble with the trial is that she doesn't escape by herself. Essentially, Hesperik has to get her out, right?
So the way it works is there's like a secondary sort of distraction, right? But Hesperik is also the one who heals her kind of like depression or fear that she's undergoing, because her, as he mentions, her physical wounds have already gone out. So he certainly aids her in her escape, but she does, you know, a decent amount of her own heavy lifting.
Okay, then that was my biggest quibble with it. But you're right, she does do a lot of the literal heavy lifting. Then the second trial here, again, it doesn't seem to me that Minitrax is the one doing a lot of this gathering of forces. Loud Thunder is the war leader from the north. Asimon brings his forces from the south. The plains people were kind of already gathered, and they're really more forced together by Loud Thunder and Asimon than Minitrax here. So while I agree that this has happened, I don't think that Minitrax does it. I think her focus is on something else. All of the other places here, but the actual trial of gathering people together is not hers.
I think you might be taking, I guess the gathering is a bit ambiguous. Loud Thunder has already brought together the North. She has, you know, brought, or by necessity, the plains people have also showed up, and then the river folk have also come up from the south. But there's two things that keep these people from the animosities that they currently have. One, there's the overarching threat of the plague people, but we also see that that in itself is not enough to stop people fighting amongst themselves. And everyone is aware of, and either honors or is respectful or just straight up afraid of Minitrax. And so I think she acts as a sort of commonality between these groups that don't have a lot in common.
I think you could also argue that she is the sort of initiating event for most of them as well. She was one of the original intrusion that precipitated that Thunder into becoming more active. She was also one of the linchpins of the river folk, basically them getting their act together. And then she herself was, you know, intimately involved with the plains people.
All right. Well, it seems like Josh is coming down one way on this. My final trial, or the final trial, rescuing Hesperik, I didn't have a problem with this one. I think that this is the most involved that Minitrax gets in the trials that we've laid out. Her rescuing Hesperik from the rat folks is part of how we get to our ultimate boon and releasing the plague people's gods. She is going into the gods' lands again and going in a different place than she has before. So there is a lot that she learns from that journey, and I think that that's fine. For the meeting with a higher power, Galathea is interesting. I'm a little surprised that you didn't go with Hesperik rescuing her from the plague people, and then Hesperik again sending her into the godlands and giving her all the information she needs to release the plague people's gods. Galathea, the information about the plague people specifically, I don't think is as helpful. She doesn't even give the information that the plague people once had the insect gods, that was also Hesperik, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Galathea doesn't know that because they themselves don't know that. So it's not something that like she can provide.
Josh, what do you think about Galathea as a higher power? What gifts do you think she's giving? And is it any more than Hesperik does?
So we had chatted a little bit about that before we started recording. I come down a little bit hard on Galathea. I really do feel, if you look at the trilogy as a whole, I'm not sure anyone would disagree that Hesperik is the clear higher power for most of this, you know, in terms of giving her abilities, gifts, and knowledge that she wouldn't otherwise have. Although he also fulfills that role as the mentor, I think, in your previous podcast on this trilogy. Galathea herself, it's hard for me to see it. It really is, in this case, for the meeting of a higher power. She herself is fairly weak and doesn't even know the whole story.
I'm torn because ultimately her ability to hear the song of her gods is instrumental to their final success.
That's true.
She's a piece of the puzzle, even a critical one, but higher power is the part that I struggle with.
Higher power is a bit odd because you only have to be, generally we accept it being a higher power in a single aspect.
Oh, I see. Okay. That would revise somewhat. I would feel like if you allow it to be even like one piece of, you know, something that they were previously unexposed to or weren't aware of, that could qualify as a higher power to them.
Yeah, I will say with Galathea, though, she ends up feeling much more like a escort quest rather than, right, Manny Track spends a lot of time talking about how, when they're in the spirit realm, the Godsland, how insubstantial Galathea is, and that definitely makes her feel like a key rather than the person granting the key.
Right. Yeah, that enunciates what I was trying to say really well. That's my main quibble with it.
For our Temptress here, I think that there is maybe a better Temptress for Many Tracks to just kind of give up, kind of the depression route. I see that fairly often in our stories here. But so I see the rats as a temptress, definitely for other people, but not as much for Many Tracks. I don't think she ever really considers the rat as an option. If I'm misremembering it, there's a scene where she's like, the rat could be a good option for us.
There is, right? A scene.
There is? Okay.
She pretty much says that when she was young, she made an altar of rat bones and she could feel it lending her strength. And then she was looking for, I'm trying to find the exact quote.
Oh, I remember. I believe
she voluntarily abandoned that.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did when she was a child. Yeah, but she's saying
destroyed that, the altar.
Yeah. No, it's too many mentions of the rat in the whole book to try to find it. But it's essentially a scene, and I just read it yesterday because I decided to reread this book. It only took a couple hours, but
Zach.
But essentially, she says, "Well, we need something to until I knew more about the rat seemed like a good option to use to fight back against the plague people." And then Hesperik goes in this big long spiel about how, I know it may seem like that, but the rat is actually worse than the plague people because the rat knows what he's doing, sort of thing.
Yeah, I'll take that. Having to get talked down by your spiritual leader that the devil you know is actually worse than the unknown.
Yeah,
I, on the other hand, welcome our new rat overlords and, you know, look forward to the bones chewed on by many teeth rather than cracked by the hyena.
For our Atoma with the Creator, it's hard to argue with literally meeting your gods, but in this case, I will argue it because Many Tracks is going into the gods land not to interact with her gods, not to ask her gods for aid at all. She doesn't want to see her gods. Actually, she wants to see the gods of the insect people. That is my biggest argument against this. And we're still entering God's land, but she is not specifically going to seek anything from her gods.
Yes, but come on, they're the god. She interacts with the gods of her people and then interacts with is it the hyena woman who's gone half crazy, who's also there helping to guide them? The coyote. Yeah, it's the coyote yeah. helping to guide them.
That's it.
She's there. She's run into a god. They talk. She gets permission to be considered one of that god's children. So that way she has the right to wander the land.
Oh, yeah. She does meet the hyena god. That's
yeah. And gets permission as all the land belongs to the hyena in the end times. Sure. It belongs to the rat.
And this is the end times.
Sure. All right. And then our apotheosis and ultimate boon. Can't argue against these. right? Like, realizing that they're insect gods. They're releasing them. This is harder for me than arguing with an atonement.
I can argue against the apotheosis that it should have been more obvious to them.
What? I don't know how that's reasonable. she had no clue until that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I figured it out a page ahead of them. So clearly Manitrax is an idiot.
Yeah, and as Alex said, the ultimate boon is pretty self-evident as far as I'm concerned.
One minor argument based on them finding the gods is the bit where I'm at. Zach said something about some of them staying, so they fail the mission to drive out the invaders forever.
They drive back the ones who don't. The ones who come to them come on bended knee. Like, literally, they come in insect form, like, groveling, like, saying...
Help us.
Yeah, help us. We don't know what's going on.
But that's just how you worm your way in. And when cultural appropriation kicks in 10 centuries from now and the insect people are in charge, they all have to bring lamps to the moth god.
Hesprek is the one that pretty much says, too, we have to take these ones in. The serpent is known for making enemies into friends or something.
And at the end of the day,
lamp.
Sorry, go ahead, Josh.
Oh, I was just going to say, at the end of the day, those are their people now. You know, just another.
They were people before, damn it.
Anyway. Well, they were literally soulless. I don't know. Like,
just because they don't believe in your gods didn't mean that.
Well, they were sort of like anti-people, right? So they're present. Only one could exist.
They had culture and society, and they could. I mean, they were the invaders. So
they did, but by having that, they took those away from the tribe people.
Yeah, they were invaders. They were invaders and bad guys, but they were still human beings anyway.
But it was like an intrinsic fact, right? So their culture and, you know, everything else was the antithesis of the tribes people. So you couldn't have coexistence in that case.
That is going to wrap up the initiation for me as I sit here raging against how the answer to a problem isn't to overcorrect the other way, Tchaikovsky. But only thing missing for me is that meeting with a higher power. It was a really solid initiation. This book, for I feel like we've been finding with a lot of our endpoints to trilogies, they either have really, really strong third book hero's journeys, or they go completely off the rails, and we're sitting pretty strong here.
And what I think Josh made a good point of, and something I wanted to bring up if we were having a problem with my particular Road to Trials, is that the multiple point of views in this book showcase a lot of instances of other characters experiencing the points on this hero's journey as well. And it's not just Manitrax, but obviously we focused on Manitrax here, but Manitrax's story probably takes up, what, 60% of the book, maybe 70, if we're being generous. And so there's a lot of room for other story points to be hit by other characters.
Fair enough. Josh, did you want to do a wrap-up for the initiation, or are you good?
I feel like I covered pretty much everything as we went on that one. Do you want to have a wrap-up for each section?
We do just a little mini one, but you don't have to do one if you don't want to. We can just move on.
I know, I can do it. I did one for the first one. okay. So for the initiation, it looks like we're all in pretty perfect agreement on all those points, especially the last three, Atonement with the Creator, Apotheosis, and the Ultimate Boon, are all pretty self-evident as far as we're concerned. The only thing that we did have some discussion on was Galathea for the meeting of the higher power. As at least as far as I'm concerned, Galathea doesn't necessarily meet what I would consider a higher power, though for the purposes of our discussion, her knowledge and abilities are beyond Manier and the people that she's interacting with for the most part.
Alex, do you feel like you're in solid agreement with us as the person arguing against this week?
Yeah.
Of course he does.
I mean, he's playing devil's advocate. His opinions, yeah, don't have to match up with what he's arguing.
In fact, they often don't.
And finding out that we've got all of these new damn immigrants coming to take our jobs and turn into bugs, we come to our return.
For the refusal to return, we have wanting the world to go back to how it was, you know, before the plague people arrived. And many tracks, along with many others, originally wants the plague people out, right? And it's up to Hesbrek to kind of convince her, as well as the others, that it's a good idea to keep these new bug people around, the former plague people, that they can, you know, they're part of their shape-shifting community. They just be a new tribe sort of thing. It's a bit of a hard stance, but that's the way it is. For the magical flight, we have a time jump. The battle takes place, and then we get several different time jumps as they kind of chase the plague people back towards the shoreline. No direct confrontations, but they want to make sure that they're out, so we get time jumps along that journey. For the rescue from without, again, we head back to the spot of the ultimate boom, which is what we like. There is that scene where she's in the God's Land, and she's essentially comatose in the real world. The plague people are kind of converging on her ritual, and the ritual is breaking apart, quote unquote, simply from the fact that they don't believe it. And she's being protected by a multitude of different characters, including Mother Bear, who dies for the cause. She gets shot down. Loud Thunder protects her. She's being protected many, many, many times while she's in the God's Land. So I think it's a really good rescue. For the crossing of the return threshold, we have returning to the sea to see the plague people off. They came from over the sea that the shapeshifters cannot traverse themselves with their technology. So they push them all the way back to their giant ironclad ships to see them off. And that's sort of the point at which we started our journey here. Is it's in the north, and it's, you know, the entry point for the people originally way back in time, the shapeshifters, when they crossed over. And it's the entry point for the plague people. So I think it's a cool return threshold. For the Master of Two Worlds, we have Minitrax being the champion, right? She still has all that power, strength, leadership ability that she's grown over the past three books. But she also has that sort of human social aspect. At the beginning of the book, she was, for all intents and purposes, like an outcast stepchild. Pretty much under lock and key in her father's / not father's home. Then she was being hunted, and then over time she developed friends and relationships. And so now she's got a large network of social interactions that I think has almost entirely been beneficial to her. And then for the freedom to live, there's not a lot showcased. It's not like we get a Harry Potter time jump or even immediate steps, but there's her interactions with the one horse boy shapeshifter whose name starts with an A, who I forget, and this idea that, you know, they can start to rebuild their society after what this war has done to them. And that things may be different, but at least they can handle it together.
For the refusal of the turn, I don't know about this. Wanting the world to go back, I don't really think that it's refusing what's happening. She's accepted that they've won, they've defeated the plague people. There's not a thought that they've lost ever, really. So it doesn't fit to me. Jack, Josh, what do you guys think?
I don't know. From my perspective, it seems very much like, hey, I've created this new world, but I'd rather we stay in the old one. And that seems pretty refusal-y to me. Josh?
Honestly, I think they're pretty forward looking on this. They definitely look at things and they say, hey, this has changed. And I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of realistic expectation that there's any way to go back to the way it used to be.
I mean, the way to do
do it would be to kill them all. There's even a scene where Hesperik has to straight up convince them to let them flee instead of continuing the routing at the sea, because he says something along the lines of, do you want these people not to go home and then to send another group just like this because they want to know what happened to them? Or do you want them to go home and say, don't go there, that place is scary as hell?
And like, yes, we were just send more, we shall eat them all.
Yeah, sort of thing. So there's definitely a faction of people who straight up want to eradicate this faction completely, and it's they have to be convinced out of it.
I mean, I guess I was just interpreting that as like that's an option that they have moving forward. But as far as like knowing that the plague people and the insect gods are out there, that you can't.
Oh no, you can't put that cat out of the bag. But if you kill them all, then at least you don't have to think about it and deal with it.
That's true. They could try to go back to normal, sort of living in denial.
All right. So for a magic flight, can't argue with a time jump because there's nothing to argue against. And for a rescue from without, I think we should have a moment of silence for Mama Bear.
But Mama Bear.
Poor Mama Bear.
At least Loud Thunder stays alive.
She rescued, man. She rescued good.
They never really talk about Mother Bear's bear form, or very rarely talk about Mother Bear's bear form. But in this scene where she dies, she goes like all out and apparently was scaring the plague people before they were like turned into insects, which is a mighty feat.
I like that she was bigger than Loud Thunder too. Like,
they always sort of implied it too when you know, when she was around.
For crossing the threshold, I like this returning to the sea to see the plague people off, but also I think we've been hinting around this point for a while, but part of this sharing the wisdom is accepting that there are plague people that are going to stay and that they will impact the society. The society is going to change because of the people who are staying. I think we've been dancing around it, but I think it's really important to highlight, like, that is part of a crossing the return threshold, part of accepting what's going to happen in this new world.
Concur.
Cool. All right. For the master,
racism.
For the master of two worlds, could you just highlight again what the two worlds are?
Yeah, the two worlds are that she's gained a mastery of is sort of a combat battle leader perspective, right? Because she's got the champion, she's learned how to fight in her all her different aspects, something that she didn't have way back when. And we also have sort of that social aspect that she's able to bring people together in a way that we see many straight up just militaristic leaders in this series, like tribes, owners, and the Eerie champion and stuff. While they may be good fighters, they don't actually bring people together. And so I think she's got both of those.
I don't know, Zach. I don't think that your Master of Two Worlds is wrong. I think it's the Master of Two Worlds thesis for this series, and this journey that you put us on in this book is very much only about her sort of humanity and spirituality. And right, we watched her master her championness, her duality in the first book, and then the second book we watched her master her ability to be a warrior, and this book is much, much more about only one world.
I like that definition a lot better, actually. Her sort of reconciling the spirituality, as you said, in the gods with her mortal and human form.
So do we want to say she's mastered the spirit world and the human world?
Yeah, she gets a happily ever after, so yes.
I'm leaning that way. I still like, Zach had a good point though. I would rephrase it a little bit, maybe something similar to previously. She was almost always either a lone fighter or with a small group, and in this one it's a straight on, you know, essentially she's leading armies,
but she's doing a lot less of the leading the army part and a lot more of
and that's the part where I think it's a much stronger point for the spirituality and like human aspect. But I do think there's something there for her development as a character and a leader.
Okay.
But more importantly, let's move on to talking about hunky, hunky boys and spending the rest of our lives with them.
Yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot there, though.
Sorry, Leaf hunky boys. He's a horse.
I think the freedom to live is fine. I would expect many tracks to not just rebuild society. I mean, she's still a champion fighter. She still has leader of the war band, like we just talked about. So I would expect her to have some strife and conflict in the rest of her life. But I like this point of rebuilding.
She 100% dies as like an older mental figure in somebody else's story 20 years from now.
Oh, yeah.
When the rat people become a problem again or something.
Mm. Anywho, there's definitely a freedom to live, which, from my perspective, puts us at the end of our return with a slam dunk. It's been a while since we had a point for point. No, not a single drop point, Zach. Alex, I don't know what to tell you, man. Many tracks is very heroic in the end here.
I'm losing my touch.
It's going to leave me at a final score of 15 out of 17, firmly a modern hero. Many tracks has a bit of an unusual start. I think she only just barely crossed the line the first time we saw her, but she's doing very, very well done archetypal hero points throughout this whole book. She is going note for note.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I came in as at 14 out of 17. The only point I left undecided was, as we talked about, the bat being the mentor figure. And yeah, Manier makes an excellent hero and has an excellent journey in this third book. And really the whole trilogy, I feel.
Bringing us in on our closing thoughts. I've liked these books, probably not as much as Zach, who fell in love with them immediately, but they have been enjoyable. I have read them most times after we finished the episodes, which is always a bit of an odd experience. It's given me a strange opinion on the first Law series and this one, but they have been very enjoyable. I've liked the characters. I've liked the world. Stepping is a pretty fun magic system. If I will say less important in mechanics after the first book, as we get sort of into the larger mythology, but maybe that's just my opinion. I feel really weird coming to a close here because in a book that's normally about how the invading colonial forces misunderstand society and all are about wiping things out, I'm normally on the side of our main characters one way or another. I tend to agree with that narrative that, you know, white people invading around the world, destroying culture, not a great system, even though it's what we did for the longest time. This book goes a little bit far, in my opinion, as I might have hinted, depending on our editing. I think the literal, they have no souls and we need to give them souls and they're not people without souls and they're therefore inferior in a different way, kind of overcorrects the far back of the they don't understand us to the they're subhuman. Generally speaking, my real world opinion tends to fall onto everyone's human kind of deal. So that part was a little bit jarring to hit as the final twist that we just need to give them souls so that way they can finally be human. Not we need to give them souls so they can understand us. It's they're not human without them. A little bit weird for me.
Yeah, I really enjoy this series too. I think that stepping, like we mentioned, is a very cool system. And I liked that we learned more about it in this book. We learned that if you're rejected from your tribe, you can go to another tribe and implore their god to give you a soul and let them step, unless you step with their form. And it's interesting to me to see that world expanded further with this. We kind of already had hints of this with the Horse Society, how they took people into them and made them horses, but it's nice to have the confirmation that everyone can do that. And it's also nice to see that the different tribes of people can interact and have relationships with many tracks and her horse friend. We see that, you know, the tribes aren't this separate entity. They can't ever interact. And that many tracks is an anomaly, but not an anomaly for being of two tribes. It's the anomaly was keeping both of those forms for as long as she did. I enjoyed how much the story focused on different characters. I really liked Hesperic and Loud Thunder. And I liked that the hyena girl, Shuri, got a lot of screen time in this. I thought her arc was very interesting. And I enjoyed her development into a hyena who was kind of going against the tracks.
Yeah, overall, I really enjoyed the series. I think that the writing had a very good sense of the world being lived in already. There's a lot of times, and I think you can fall prey to this, especially in a book that's got more primitive leanings, right? Where, you know, this is kind of seem like a prehistoric sort of tribalism setting. So it could feel like a new, fresh world, but the references to the different ancient kingdoms and the reoccurrence of the rat people and everything made this world feel very lived in to me, which I really enjoyed. My question to everyone here on the show, even Josh here, is that did you feel like the magic system and the spiritual system, reading the first two books, I actually thought that the gods weren't real and that it was all just kind of in the individual's psyche. Like this is all just people's mass delusion, and that the magic system obviously was real, but that the gods themselves weren't a real thing and that people were all just convincing themselves of it. But it wasn't until,
there's a little bit of the belief system magic because right, as you talk about there, the sheer lack of soulness and belief from the plague people does begin to collapse.
I obviously really enjoyed the series. I think it was the initial recommendation for you guys to take a look at this one for the podcast. So Jackman, interesting point. I actually hadn't really thought about that in the context of a sort of meta narrative about white people imperialism over the centuries. But that does make a lot of sense in hindsight. I will say that I mostly enjoyed the kind of going on what Zach had said. I really, really liked the world that was established here. The sort of spiritual approach to the gods and to their the expression of their inner animal as part of the culture of the different tribes really came through and made the world feel very genuine. It wasn't like super in your face, although it definitely wasn't subtle either, but the different tribes sort of, emulated their namesake to a certain extent. And I felt like that the interactions between them that were all the more richer for that.
So where did we fall on the fact that did everyone else think the gods were real?
I just kind of took them for granted. Gods tend to either be an overbearing presence in books or not appear at all. I felt like the midpoint in this particular series was at least a little novel for me, and I enjoyed it a lot.
I had just read a YA series before we started the first one of these, the Poppy Wars, that had a similar, it was like the Chinese gods and they did drugs in order to ascend to the pantheon. And there's a big question in the third book when they're fighting the English equivalent and she gets hit with like an electric shock and it severs her ability to communicate with them, whether their gods are real or whether the Christian god analog is real. And so I was already in that headspace of like, hey, when we were reading about the plague people, my thought was, hey, their gods are probably real to them. And the plague people's like hollowness is probably another god's influence kind of deal, right? Like different pantheons colliding. I was wrong, but that was the headspace I was in.
Yeah, I assumed that the gods weren't real until that first time we went to the gods land. And
even the gods land to me, at least to the gods land to me, just seemed like a fever dream. It just seemed like something that they were just like straight up chatting about.
Really? That's interesting.
And do drugs to see God, boy. And
it wasn't until it was like all just a bunch of mass delusion until we actually got her releasing the gods for the insect gods in this last scene that I went, oh,
okay, I guess the gods are real.
I think you might have been living in a little bit of denial there.
They can turn into animals. There's definitely magic, so gods aren't a huge step.
No, that's not. It's not a huge step. I just thought it was like a. We've all convinced ourselves this is kind of what the gods doing. You don't actually feel the ripple of the serpent underneath the earth. You just convinced yourself that you do.
Oh, I do feel the ripple of the serpent underneath the earth, Zach. Or my neighbors are doing some yoga. Thank you so much for joining us. If you enjoy Hero's Journey as much as we love doing it, don't forget to leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts from. It really helps us out and we love to hear from you. And if you get your podcast through Spotify, because you haven't canceled it yet, if you get your podcast through Spotify, don't forget that we leave our poll questions there for you to answer. As always, I have been your host and judge, Jack.
This is Alex.
And I'm Zach.
And I'm Josh.
Thank you so much for joining us, Josh. It's been a real pleasure to have you on, and thank you for suggesting this series. It was a blast to read. And join us next week when we will be going back to Narnia for The Magician's Nephew.
Yay!
Oh, thank you.
I'm just now imagining a man-sized bat with a Gandalf hat.
That's kind of what he was, though.
I like to think of them more as like, you guys remember Bartok from Anastasia?
With a ha and a cha and a
but not comedic.
And I kick her, sir.
I like to think that they looked like the, when they're in human form, they looked like the bad guy from
Rasputin.
Yeah, Rasputin.
And then they transform into Bartok.
And then they transform into a big, big version of Bartok, but still very serious.